Digital 410 Productions proudly presents the What's the Scuttlebutt podcast with your hosts, Dodd Abernathy, Jeff Copsetta, and Henry Sledge.
Welcome, everybody, to another episode of the What's the Scuttlebutt podcast, your favorite World War II podcast. And I want to thank each and every one of you for joining us for another night of history on this Monday night. And joining us, as always, from Texas is the one and only Jeff Copsetta. And joining
What's
us,
going on?
As always, is the ever faithful Henry Sledge. Henry, Jeff, how are you gentlemen doing tonight?
Fantastic.
Outstanding.
Could you sound any more enthused, Henry? Like, fantastic. Things are great. Thanks for asking.
Oh, it couldn't be better, man. Sorry.
I'm just playing
it's
with
the
it.
The biggest I've seen him smile.
That is true. We do have a new profile picture up on the What's the Scuttlebutt podcast. We fell in line with everybody else using the cool historical filter last week, and Henry actually sent us like the only photo we have in our entire inventory of him with three quarters of a smile. So if you want to enjoy that in all its glory, go check out our Facebook page and our Instagram page. But Henry, why don't you do the honors of introducing our guest tonight?
Okay, and I'll try to smile while I'm doing it. If you like historical podcasting, it does not get any better than who we have on deck for you tonight. We have Dan Carlin in with us. He's been referred to as the king of long-form podcasting. He is a pioneer of podcasting. He's been in the game a while. He's got hardcore history with Dan Carlin with over 100 million downloads, if not more than that. So my friend Dan Carlin, we're really happy to have you, Dan.
Thanks for having me on, guys. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much for coming on.
So I was, Dan, can you just give us like a thumbnail sketch of how you got from graduating college in 1989 with a BA in history, which is right around the time I got out, to the superlatives that are used to describe what you do? I know it's a long road, but thumbnail sketch of how you got to this point. Obviously an endemic love of history.
Oh yeah. I like to look at it as sort of a inspirational story for other people, because boy, there were so many times along the way where I was just going, what am I doing? You know, I mean, and looking at my age and going, I should be farther than I am now, and all these kinds of things. So to have you say all those nice things about me, it's a bit of a miracle from my point of view. The answer to the question though is, when you get out of college and sometimes you have a degree that obviously leads you in a certain direction, right? You get a law degree, you start trying to become a lawyer. The history degree is a lot more sort of amorphous. I mean, what do you naturally run into? Right. And I ended up in the news business. And the funny part about the news business was, after a while, you find out that a lot of the reporters that you really admire, the ones that they trust with those complicated stories with big, you know, back tales involved and everything, we're all history majors also. So what's that line that journalism is the first draft of history? So it doesn't hurt to have somebody trained in history to be a journalist. And so, you know, and then you follow opportunities along the way, right? You take the left turn at Albuquerque when it shows up, and all of a sudden you're podcasting in 2005, and you become a pioneer, as you called me, sort of accidentally and, you know, serendipitously, right? Right place, right time kind of thing.
Did you feel like you had an unusual love of reading compared to other journalists and people who were in radio at that time?
Oh, I don't know. I think most of the people that I worked with that were the real serious types were all reading. I mean, it was sort of a prerequisite for the job. I will say I was reading some strange stuff when I was a little boy. And, you know, there were a lot of adults asking weird questions like, why has he got the rise and fall of the Third Reich, you know, as a 5-year-old? So, I mean, there were lots of questions my parents asked, but and that may be a little unusual. But once you get into journalism, I mean, this was the days before the internet. We were reading 5, 6, 7 newspapers a day as part of the job. So, and nobody was getting off without doing the reading.
Yeah, this is when you had to verify with 2 to 3 different sources before you even thought about going to publish with it.
It's funny that seems so old school, because they were talking about the decline of journalism way back then. And from where we stand now, it looks like some sort of golden age. You know?
Well, you know, it's funny. I did a short 6 years in terrestrial radio, and the guys that I produced for their afternoon show, they had been on the same station here in Fort Myers since 1997, and I was working for them in 2013. And since they had been on the radio so long, they had that old school training of like, whenever I would do something during the show, if there was a shooting or something breaking news wise, they said, hey, before you come back on the air with it, verify it with 2 credible sources. So they still had that old school mentality even back in 2013. But a lot of people nowadays, it almost seems like their motto is now, let's run with it first and we'll worry about apologizing for it later.
I remember the big change too. You can see it. The big change happened because we used to not, like, I was at an ABC station in Los Angeles, and that's sort of where I learned how to do the job. And we couldn't quote any other TV stations. Mm-hmm. So you couldn't give sort of props to NBC or CBS. These are like corporate verboten kind of things. And it dovetailed into the news mission rather nicely. And I remember watching TV, and I don't remember the year, but it was like the Monica Lewinsky stuff. It was that whole era where simply being able to go really fast started to become really important. And all of a sudden, somebody broke that barrier where on one network station, they'll say, NBC is reporting. Well, yep. And then once that started happening, it just, like, the floodgates opened. It was like breaking some commandment. And once you do it, you know, then everybody does it.
Yeah, because the commandment was you don't mention the competition, even if you're bad-mouthing them, because you don't want somebody to go say, well, let's go hear how bad exactly. they truly are. And, now it's CNN and Fox News just going at each other all night, throwing each other all around.
Exactly right. It was, and because there was the zero-sum era of media where if you're watching NBC at 8 o'clock, you can't be watching ABC at 8 mm-hmm. o'clock. Now, of course, you know, nobody cares because you can watch them both.
Just like if you got booked as a comedian, if you got booked on Carson, you were not getting booked on Letterman.
That's right.
Soon.
That's right. The old blacklisting. Absolutely right.
Go ahead.
Do you feel like, go ahead, Don.
No, go ahead.
Do you feel like, Dan, that you have a particular interest in a certain area of history? Like, I know, obviously, you've done a lot of World War II content, but you're really well-rounded. I mean, like, when it comes to history, I'm pretty much in one lane. My primary interest is going to be World War II, maybe some other stuff, but it's usually going to be that. It seems like your shows that I've checked out really cover a broad spectrum.
Well, I appreciate you saying that because it probably describes why I wouldn't have become a historian or a good historian, because I could never narrow it down, you know, where you really need a narrow slice and you really need to become a real mm-hmm. expert, you know, Anglo-Saxon literature or something like, and I just couldn't focus on, I mean, I love so many things. But there's definitely, I mean, really, the funny thing is if, and listeners have done this, where they've plotted out the subject matter of the various podcasts, and it does tend to fall into several main areas. And so I'll get letters, emails, I'm showing my age now, from people who will say, you know, can you please do a show on 17th century India or something? And I have to say, I would do a really bad show on 17th century India because I don't know anything about it. So all the shows are representative of interests that I had mm-hmm. once or upon a time in my life. And I just have enough foundation so that I can build the new research off of that. But there's tons of stuff I know nothing about, to be actually honest.
Well, that's when the prospect of having a quote unquote expert on to help basically fill in those gaps. You may know a little something about something like we do here. You know, the three of us know a lot about a lot, but we don't know everything about everything. And so we bring in a third party who can fill in those gaps and kind of answer our questions. And that's where the guest really comes into play for some of those episodes.
That's what the Hardcore History Addendum series that we started is. So I could do the 17th century India show. I just have to have a historian of 17th century India on with me. I can ask the right questions, right?
And I'm sure the journalism background, especially the format you do, you know, you do these long form formats and, you know, you do a lot of studying, a lot of pre-scripting and all that, with the exception of your what you refer to as your Blitz episodes. And I'm sure, you know, the radio journalism and all that, just how to write copy and try to condense it, even though you're, you know, 2-3 hour podcast, but condensing it down. But you know the steps of telling a story in a way in which it flows and keeps people's attention. I'm sure a lot of that came from your years in journalism and radio both.
Well, actually, yeah, because there are no scripts. There's nothing written down. Yeah. And that's all from radio because mm-hmm. you guys know there's a format in radio, like a talk radio format on a news station where you have news at the top of the hour. You have all these breaks that are programmed into it. And then you have time to talk within those spaces. And there's always, like at the beginning of an opinion show, I would do 3 hours a day, 5 days a week. And I used to say I was a pretty good talk show host two of those days. That was the problem. There was like a 12 to 15 minute intro section where you sort of do the monologue, right? And you yep. lay out the say, you make your case. And that was always the part I was best at. It was kind of all downhill from there. And the first podcast that we did were sort of 15, 16, 17 minutes long, sort of take it was just that part. And then long-winded as I am and with the ability to edit pieces together and everything mm-hmm. else, they just the real problem, to be honest with you, is that these stories ended up taking more time to tell properly.
Yeah.
And so they would just grow in the telling. I'm kind of ashamed of having 5.5 hour long shows, even though the listeners that still listen to those like them. But I mean, that was never the intention.
Well, I mean, podcast is the perfect format because most of your listeners, I'm sure, they either listen to you in the car on the way to work, they listen to you on the way back, then get back in, listen to the gym or walking the dog, going to the kids' basketball game, whatever. And so that episode, yeah, it may be 5 hours long, but it fills so much of people's time, their idle time, that, you know, they're happy it takes that long because, hey, I got 3 days worth of content here. I don't have to sit down and listen to all one of
them. They're not getting anything more from me for a long time. So it takes us so long to get those suckers out. You just better ration it and like make it last.
I can imagine. How many are you? Obviously, you probably do a lot of your editing yourself, but how many people do you have on your team over there?
Oh, there's one creative, and that's me, and then possibly somebody else, but that's about it.
Yeah, it's just easier to keep your idea of the way you want your show to go.
And you know what? I don't want to manage people. I'm not a good people manager. I have enough problems staying in my own lane. And the more people we have, the more I'd have to do that because I have this leadership pyramid designed like a pyramid, and I can't delegate very well. And so keeping the group small is important.
Yeah, and it minimizes employee complaints. You can talk bad about yourself,
that's
but you
right.
know.
That's right. I complain. That's me.
My introduction to what you did was Supernova in the East. And a friend of mine put me onto that, and I checked it out, started listening to it. I was really, the thing I thought was so cool about it was you go in with the Japanese Empire as they come to power going into China, and you explore that, which I just finished Richard Frank's book, Tower of Skulls, here.
He's great, isn't he? Ago.
Yeah, that is a very deep scholarly study of the subject. I'm glad he's doing a trilogy of it, but I loved the way you explored all the China, the Manchuria aspects of it. Not only that, but you explored a lot of themes with what we did in the war against Japan. And maybe I'm jumping too far ahead here, but you explored a lot of moral questions without doing any of this. Oh, we've got to be self-recriminating and judge ourselves as a nation, because you say contextually, you say you have to look at this in the moral calculus of 1945. You know, why did we firebomb Tokyo? Well, look at what was going on in 1945 leading up to that. Look at what was going on in the strategic calculus. It was just the way you tied all that together, I just thought was really well done and really laid it out very well.
Well, you might actually like a show that we did a while ago called Logical Insanity, and it was an exploration. It was essentially supposed to be about the atomic bomb, but you can't understand the atomic bomb without understanding the idea of strategic bombing and how it developed right to begin with. And the part that always blows me away about this is if you read and really get into the sources, the people that were advocates, and you guys, I'm sure, all know this, but for any audience members who might not, the people, because you ask yourself, who in their right mind, and these were our neighbors, my next door neighbor was a guy who was a lieutenant colonel in the Air Force, a fighter pilot. And so, I mean, we would have these conversations and you say, how can Mr. Downey go and bomb, you know, people in these cities? But that's not how it went. In their minds, there's a strategic rationale for this that says you are shortening the war. And in a right war where you can literally look at the casualties like a tote board reliably, 8, 10, 9, you know, I mean, thousands of people every day, that if you shorten that war, you shorten the death total, right? So the idea behind Logical Insanity was to explore this idea about how good human beings can actually come to the decision that bombing Dresden to rubble is humanitarian and helpful, right? And it's a fascinating way to look at how people live with themselves and how these things come to be amongst even the so-called good guys, right? And mm-hmm. there were people after the war, and there are still people today that will back up this idea that strategic bombing used correctly will shorten a conflict's duration, that shortening a conflict's duration is humanitarian, you know, on its face. I mean, it's a fascinating subject to try to get into, so that when you get to the atomic bomb, the rationale's already been set up, and it's been set up over two world wars, you know, in decades. I find it one of the most fascinating parts of American 20th century history, actually.
And I think it was one of the addendum shows I listened to today you did with Ian Toll.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I loved him. He was great.
He actually just finished his first volume, Pacific Crucible. And he talks about how there were two aspects to the war. And he's the first person I've ever heard say this. But he said there were two aspects to it. There was a sequential aspect, which was, you know, you start at point A, invade point B, point C, and so on. But then you had the cumulative aspect where you're chipping away at say, Germany's war productive capability via strategic bombing, or the Japanese war making capability via strategic bombing. I never heard it put that way, but I thought that was pretty fascinating.
Oh, there's a great book by Adam Tooze called The Wages of Destruction. And Tooze's book, you know, when you're like we are, we've all read Second World War books since we were children, practically. It's hard to give us a new angle, although every generation of historians tries to, right? Ian Toll's an economist. He's focused on economics. And I thought, oh, God, do I really want to dive into a book on economics? It was the first book that I've read in my lifetime that all of a sudden the Third Reich's foreign policy decisions made sense to me. And so check that book out, because what he's showing is the things that would be way too boring to show an average neophyte on the Second World War who wants to hear, you know, the big picture stuff. But it's all the resources that they were lacking and the timelines that they had. And all of a sudden, you know, when I was a kid, they used to say things like Hitler was crazy. And that's the only thing that can explain Germany's crazy foreign policy decisions. Ian Toll's book, The Wages of Destruction, is the best example where I've ever come out of the book going, okay, I really understand things about that better than I did. The other one, by the way, is Albert Speer's book, Inside the Third Reich.
Mm-hmm.
Classic.
I can't remember the author's name, but there's another one called The Pathology of Evil. It's about Adolf Hitler and his childhood and all that. That, to me, presented a lot of good evidence of why Hitler did a lot of the crazy things he did. And so that's another one if you want a little bit of an insight on his personality and what some believe drove him to make the decisions he did. It's called Pathology of Evil.
That's a fascinating situation, yes.
You know, I tried, when I was a kid, Dan, I tried to read my dad's copy of Rise and Fall of the Third Reich by William Shirer. And I don't know how many hundreds of pages I got into it before I just, I just lost. It's not very often I start a book and not finish it, but I may have gotten 300 pages into it. But who was it today you were talking about? It was another one of the addendum shows. They were saying, yeah, it may have been you that said some minutiae that Shirer was talking about the German economy. I can't remember what it was. I wish I could remember the metaphor, but it was some really fine economic detail, and whoever you were talking to was saying, man, that was kind of hard to get through that part.
You know what's great about him, though? Like, when I was a kid, I read it one way. And when I go back, there's several books that I've read multiple times and gotten different things out of it at different stages in my life. That book is now a wonderful sort of time capsule, because it's Second World War history from a lot closer to the Second World War. And mm-hmm. So the biases from the time period are really heavily involved. And also the fog of war, as we all know, lasts a long time after the conflict is over. And he was essentially starting that book as a functioning journalist during the war. Right. So it's like when you go back and I still do this, because you'll never see anything like this, and go watch some of the episodes from The World at War, that series that we grew up with.
Yes.
Like Thames Television. And the reason it's so great is they have, even though it's so biased because it's so close to the conflict, they have all the participants. And yeah. I mean, the generals, they have all of them. And, you know, you'll only have that chance to get those people on tape talking about it for a limited number of decades after the conflict. But it's created an invaluable resource. It's not the way you would do the story today, knowing mm-hmm. what we know now. But my God, you put it on and you just feel like, where are you going to get something like this again, you know?
Well, that brings me to a quote I heard on your show recently that said something along the lines of, the problem with history is we always apply today's politics to history of the old. And kind of what you're saying, when you go back and watch those old World of War episodes that were filmed in the 50s, a short, 8 years after the war, the opinion's a lot different compared to stuff that may be produced on the same subject matter, but with today's historians and today's experts who would apply our policies and politics of today, how that history has changed a little bit.
That is a great quote to bring up, and it's worth remembering. We should say it's from Ohio State University historian Robert C. Davis, and he said, history is often as not our present politics projected onto the past. And listen, that's, as we all know, that's what historiography is, right? Historians trying to figure out how to weed out the biases of the contemporary sources, right? Great point to bring up.
And I was saying this a few years ago when we were going through that era of let's tear down the statues, regardless of, then we even went off the rails and it was like, wait a minute, no, you don't want to tear that statue down. It's like, in the mid to early 2000s, we've already seen you know, some people in the Middle East started trying to claim that, you know, certain aspects of World War II didn't happen and they're trying to redefine history. It's like, well, who's to say 80 years from now, we don't have a group of people who have a certain mindset trying to redefine or deny that certain aspects of the Civil War never happened, because here we are taking down all the monuments, erasing the history. It's like, a monument doesn't have to be a celebration of something that happened. It's just a reminder of what happened so we don't repeat it. To look at every monument as a celebration, I think, is a huge disservice. And if you don't look at every monument as a celebration, but as a historical reminder, then, you know, maybe we can get away with not tearing statues down and it's, you know, and help preserve our history.
Yeah, but, you know, there's a long history of human beings doing that. And we always sort of celebrate it when it's Joseph Stalin's statue being toppled, right?
Or Saddam Hussein.
Or Ashurbanipal back in the Assyrian Empire getting his eye carved out by some Median who's just, you know, taken the capital down in ancient times. I mean, because those are symbols, as times change and attitudes change, the symbols often take the brunt of it. I mean, go look at those Egyptian hieroglyphics where somebody has scratched out the name of some ruler to try to eliminate them from the memory of world history. I mean, it's funny, but I look at this as just a complicated part of humanness and wrapped up into who we are. I mean, I don't get into the current politics of it as much as I look at it and go, we people just do crap like that. That's who we are.
Absolutely. And kind of on that subject too, I was listening.
I love that dog.
Oh, it's Miss Bailey, the Boston Terrier. She's a sweetheart.
That's the co-pilot.
Yep. She comes in and decides when it's time to make an appearance. I was listening to your episode on human resources, and you kind of started that episode off with hey, you know, a lot of people told me not to go down this road because of what the subject matter is, but, you know, you believe it's important to share the subject matter because it's history. Do you find yourself kind of, maybe not yourself, but kind of people suggesting, hey, don't touch that subject more and more nowadays than opposed to when you first started all those years ago?
I think so. You know, sometimes with history, you're a little safer, but not always.
Yeah.
And you can't be afraid of this stuff, though. It becomes a challenge. So, you try to figure out, okay, if this is such a landmine of a hot button issue now, how can we diffuse it? How can we tell it in a way where, because I feel like the sheer fact that other people are shying away from it makes it particularly fertile ground, right? Because it's you know, unplowed by other people, but it's unplowed by them because there's landmines everywhere.
Yep.
And trying to figure out how not to get blown up while you're talking about them is important. But you know, I as you get older, I'm always finding it interesting to find out what younger people don't know. And it's not because this generation knows less than the last generation. It's because all younger people know less than 56-year-old guys, because I've been around longer. So I was watching these videos of younger people, 20, 22, 23, listening to music that I would assume everybody in the whole world has heard, right? Beatles or something like that. And they're going, I never heard this stuff before. What? And so now let's take that non sequitur of an idea and apply it to history, too. I always assume that things like the history of slavery in a broad sort of sense is something people understand. Because when I was growing up, it was really this period of showing Roots on television as an event, the autobiography of Miss Jane Pittman. I mean, there was a concerted effort in that time period, maybe the first time period in American history really ever, to look into this subject. And I have to remember that wears off.
Mm-hmm.
Just like the stuff when we grew up, it was all about showing you movies about nuclear war and talking about how dangerous and awful that would be. But that wears off too, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so that was the part about the human resources that I was a little surprised, is it didn't seem that it should be a